that building is where Al Jazeera's offices are. Another strike on that tower.
That the world will know less about what's going on in Gaza because that building was leveled.
And we will continue to respond forcefully until the security of our people is reinstated.
By some of the worst communal violence there in several years.
Hello, I'm Richard Gisbert, and you're at The Listening Post, where we don't cover the news, we cover the way the news is covered. Here are the media stories we're examining this week. Journalism comes under Israeli fire in Gaza, and inside Israel, incitement on the airwaves is only making things worse. In Qatar, a Kenyan who blogged about life as a migrant worker finds himself in custody, but the authorities have yet to produce a charge. Beijing gets some help with its propaganda push on Xinjiang. From a band of Western influencers online. And what do we call home? The viral video that shows the meaning of dispossession in Palestine. 2 weeks of intense, devastating Israeli bombing has overwhelmed the Gaza Strip's 2 million inhabitants. High-rise buildings housing civilians and news organizations, this network included, have been reduced to rubble. Still, the Israeli government and its military enjoy a kind of diplomatic impunity. Some of that has to do with Israel's traditional ability to dominate the media space, to focus the narrative on anti-Hamas talking points. But Gaza is only one part of this rapidly moving story. Across Israel and the occupied territories, Palestinians have erupted in protest. Israeli cities like Lid and Aqa have seen mob violence, most of it directed at Palestinian citizens. And it's organized, often with the cover of Israeli security forces. Some voices on the Israeli airwaves who call themselves journalists have been guilty of incitement. The images of intercommunal violence so close to home have shaken the Israeli public in a way that the video from Gaza and the West Bank failed to do. That's our starting point this week, the Gaza Strip, where a ceasefire has just come into effect.
We are trying to degrade Hamas's terrorist.
Israelis are under constant fire.
After 11 days of bombing Gaza, brought to an end by a ceasefire, the Israeli government is still all in on the information war. Among the stories it is asking the world to believe, that Gaza's only COVID-19 testing facility was a legitimate target, along with its biggest bookshop and a mattress factory. That the leveling of this 12-story building had nothing to do with the Palestinian news organizations and international ones that had offices there.
An intelligence office for the Palestinian terrorist organization housed in that building that plots and organizes the terror attacks against Israeli civilians. So it's a perfectly legitimate target.
That the Associated Press and Al Jazeera, two key players in documenting this latest war on Gaza, weren't the targets. They just happened to have bureaus in the building. Collateral damage, nothing more.
The Israeli narrative really was twofold. It claimed that Hamas, which is the movement that governs the Gaza Strip, has military assets within the building, which justifies targeting the building.
And what evidence is there, do you believe, that that building housed Hamas militants?
Everyone knew the secret, so to speak, AP, AFP, Al Jazeera.
Sorry, but
they all well knew for
I'm
years
that we've spoken to the head of the Associated Press. He had absolutely
Hamas
no idea
Islamic Jihad.
That Hamas
and Hamas's effort to use what the Israeli authorities call human shields, which is to hide among civilian neighborhoods to deter Israel from targeting these targets. The reality is that there has been extensive investigations into these claims about human shielding, and there have been no way to verify these claims.
Now, imagine if it was the other way around and Hamas destroyed a high-rise in Tel Aviv and used the justification that it was housing Israeli military officials. And indeed, many Israeli military buildings are in central Tel Aviv. Buildings with an international presence in Gaza are considered safer than others because it's presumed that Israel won't bomb them. But the sad and devastating reality is that there is really no safe space in Gaza.
How long can you say Israel has the right to defend itself? Enough with that already. Against journalists? Really? An entire tower being flattened? That sends a message that we're not going to let you control the narrative. We want to control the narrative.
Israel also targets news content on the Middle East. For example, had you watched our report on Gaza last week, the version posted on YouTube, it might have been preceded by this ad from Israel's Ministry of Strategic Affairs. Media organizations like Al Jazeera and AP have the resources to fight back, to find new office space, replace equipment. But small Palestinian media outlets in Gaza do not. They're vital sources of local news, and they've been targeted repeatedly.
And they also have to rebuild their offices and work from scratch and buy expensive equipment that was lost and replenish archives that have been totally destroyed. And these smaller Palestinian media outlets have played a vital role in telling the world what is really going on in Gaza.
Israel invests a lot of money in communicating with the outside world. There's a term in Hebrew for this. It's called hasbara. And hasbara means explanation. And that's really what someone like Mark Regev, who is a professional diplomat, is being sent to do when he goes and is interviewed on MSNBC or CNN.
Well, we didn't want this conflict. On the contrary, we took a number of steps exactly a week ago before this erupted to try to de-escalate steps that the US government praised us for. But unfortunately, Hamas was hell-bent on initiating this conflict.
His job is to explain to the broader world why Israel is doing what it's doing. But I think that what we've been beginning to see over the last few days is that those talking points aren't really working.
A story that was set off in East Jerusalem with the protests over the looming expulsion of Palestinians from their homes to make way for Jewish Israelis. And then engulfed Gaza when the bombing began, has had a poisonous effect in Israel itself, in mixed cities like Lid, Acca, and Jaffa. The communal violence, the public lynchings captured on camera, some of them broadcast live on Israeli television, have gone both ways. But there is no Palestinian equivalent for the mobs of armed Israeli settlers that were bussed into those cities, allowed in by Israeli police. Israeli reporters are free to hold power to account, and on domestic political matters usually do. But their journalism on Palestinians, issues pertaining to the occupation, is far less reliable and much more partisan. Put the country on a war footing, and many will toe the line, and then some. Talking heads like Dov Gilhar of the state-owned channel Khan, who calls Palestinians the enemies within, who, just prior to interviewing Palestinian journalist Rami Yunus, asked repeatedly on the air if it was time for the Israelis to reload the guns.
תקן אותי אם אני טועה, זה מה שעשית עכשיו?
השאלה הייתה...
אותו גילהר, זה מה שעשית עכשיו?
כן, אז שאלת, אני אענה לך. השאלה הייתה לניצב אקסול.
When I confronted him about that, he said that, no, what do you want from me? It was a question. Now we know these tricks. Right? There's a question, which is a fair question, and there's a way to incite under the guise of journalism.
אני באתי ושלחתי לכם המון חומר של פורעים יהודים שתוקפים בתים, אנשים, נשים וטף, שוטרי יסם שתוקפים ביחד איתם ברמלה ובלוד, ואתם לא מראים את זה.
He didn't care that the Jewish side is the one with the heavy weaponry. Videos of police officers attacking Palestinians.
מה אתה מציע? שלא תהיה אך ורק ערבית והיא תהיה יודן ראוס? להוציא את היהודים החוצה? זה מה שאתה מציע?
He's looking for the false equivalence. It's an inflammatory kind of coverage, a way of justifying violence and repression of Palestinian protests.
אני מנסה לספר את הסיפור המלא. אני מנסה לתת את מה שאתם כבר שלושה ימים לא עשיתם בתקשורת הישראלית.
Israeli media, generally, when there is a war, reporters sort of fall in line behind the government.
אלה לא אימותים בערים המעורבות. אלה פוגרומים שמבצעים ערבים ביהודים בערים המעורבות.
Mostly reproducing the talking points that the IDF spokesperson has given them, but they sort of go the extra mile and begin to call for military action themselves.
אחת נופלת במגרש כדורגל ביישוב ערבי גדול. לצערנו הרב, זה לא הביא להמוני הרוגים שם.
Israel is up against some inconvenient facts and figures about its occupation and the Palestinians it dominates across their historic homelands. Usually, when Israel wages war on Gaza, Ceasefires can take weeks to go into effect, even months. This one took just 11 days. 11 days of death and destruction, brought to an end, as Palestinians see it, by mass mobilization and a general strike inside Israel and across the occupied territories. The curfews imposed on Israeli cities, the bombs that fell on Gaza, could not stop that mobilization. Because Palestinians don't need to be on the streets to do that. Not anymore. All they need is a phone and their cause.
This kind of mobilization across colonized Palestine from the river to the sea is really important because it's unprecedented, certainly in my generation. In the midst of Israeli fragmentation of the Palestinian people, we are still able to come together for a shared cause against ethnic cleansing, against settler colonialism.
The Zionist ideology is all about Jewish supremacy. You have guests who are inciting against us.
אין מים, אין חשמל, אין אוכל, אין תרופות, אין דלק, אין כלום.
The TV presenters are inciting against us. The Israeli police officer sees that. The Israeli soldier sees that. The Israeli pilot sees that. And what do? After they see that? They take revenge. What we're seeing now is a proof that we haven't lost. That the Palestinian struggle, the Palestinian cause, is pretty much alive and kicking, and it's being led by us. We don't need the world to come and free us, right? We can do it ourselves. All we need from the world is to be aware of what's happening to us and to apply a little bit more pressure on Israel to stop its crimes against us.
In the Arab Gulf state of Qatar, a Kenyan security guard who also blogged about life as a migrant worker in Qatar was arrested earlier this month. He's still in custody. Johanna Hoos has been tracking this story. Jo, what do we know about this case?
Well, the security guard's name is Malcolm Badali. As you said, a Kenyan, and one of the many foreign workers who make up the vast majority of Qatar's population. Now, before his arrest, Badali blogged under the pen name Noah about migrant workers in Qatar. On May 5th, a Qatari official confirmed to Al Jazeera that, quote, Badali was taken into custody and placed under investigation for violating Qatar's security laws and regulations. However, no details were given on his whereabouts, his well-being, or whether or not he had access to a lawyer.
In the absence of those details, what do we know about what he was blogging about?
Well, according to human rights groups Amnesty International, Badali was, quote, on the front line of the fight to reform Qatar's labor laws. And his blogs focused on issues like long working hours, low wages, poor working conditions, unsuitable accommodation. Again, at this stage, we do not know whether or not his arrest was in any way related to his writings, but critics have said that this case is a clear example of the limits to freedom of speech in Qatar, which also funds this network, Al Jazeera, in particularly the sensitivity around migrant workers.
And the Football World Cup is coming up in Qatar next year, so all eyes are on that country.
Yes, and there have been numerous media reports about deaths among migrants working on the construction of those stadiums for the World Cup. But Qatar has said that it has introduced a series of reforms to its labor laws, which the International Labor Organization has called historic, including minimum wage for migrant workers. But human rights organizations say that Qatar still has a long way to go. And with the tournament just over a year away, it seems very likely that this is going to remain a contentious issue.
Okay, thanks, Joe. It's been nearly 5 years now since the Chinese Communist Party's campaign of mass internment and forced labor began in Xinjiang. We've reported on Beijing's propaganda over stories of an estimated 1.5 to 3 million Uyghur Muslims and other minorities being sent to internment camps. Beijing started with a strategy of denial on the existence of the camps, producing documentaries showing happily reformed Uyghurs. Then came a more aggressive approach, strictly controlled access for foreign journalists, threats made against critical reporters. It is clear that a new phase of official spin is now underway. China's adding some Western faces to the mix, white ones, online influencers who contend that the Xinjiang story is being overblown by the Western media, that reports of all those people being put away are either just flat-out false or, if true, represent nothing more than a proportionate, legitimate response to a national security threat. The Listening Post's Meenakshi Ravi now on the Western Voices contesting claims of a genocide in Xinjiang.
What's up, guys? I'm coming at you from Jiangxi, China, and in today's episode, I'm going to be talking about
I would like to talk about the China dream, right?
You said that this is the new America.
I've been saying it for 10 years.
China has 1.4 billion people, and it has a very vibrant internet scene.
It's a fascinating time to be a Sinophile. There's been a spike in interest in all things China.
Year after it all began, China is back to where it started. A new lockdown has been announced.
India's media has erupted with anti-Chinese sentiment.
At a press briefing in Beijing today, the foreign...
Along with boosting journalism and academic study about the country, it's also given a new prominence to a niche group of China watchers aiming to understand the country from the inside.
When you hear the word China, what's the first thing that comes to your mind?
And who denounce the mainstream Western consensus on China.
China?
For the past couple of months, these particular voices have all been speaking about one topic.
What's up, guys? Coming at you from Kashgar, ancient city in Xinjiang.
There's a really good reason why Western media and governments use terms like forced labor, concentration camps, and even genocide when they're talking about Xinjiang, China.
Hey everyone, I finally arrived at the cotton farm here in Xinjiang, Aksu.
The first thing I noticed about the video from Roz Galore is there were a lot of propaganda messages in it right up front.
Dude, this is great.
He visits a cotton farm in Xinjiang. They're using drones to sprinkle pesticide on the fields, like all this stuff to kind of prove that, you know, there's no slave labor here.
Breaking news, guys, they're forcing drones to work here in the cotton fields in Xinjiang.
If you didn't know anything about what was happening in Xinjiang, you'd think, oh, great, you know, this farmer family, they're pretty prosperous.
So there are a number of foreigners, many of them based in China, that post these videos, some on Chinese platforms such as Bilibili, but many on YouTube as well, because they do want to target audiences outside of China.
You know, one of the things that's strange about being a foreigner who loves China is when I go to the West, I become an unofficial spokesman for China.
One thing I want to highlight is that it's very hard to say how much of the feedback they get is actually paid for by the Chinese state itself. Because managed online commentator systems that the party state employs would also send out tasks to people to, you know, amplify something, repost something, comment on something.
Influencers like Canadian Daniel Dumbrill, Israeli Roz Galore, or the British father-son duo Lee and Ollie Barrett have followers in the millions on the video sharing site Bilibili, TikTok, and Weibo, China's version of Twitter. No one has provided any evidence that the Chinese government has directly paid these influencers to churn out their videos. The vloggers themselves recently, in a curiously simultaneous push, posted videos refuting allegations that they are paid by the Chinese Communist Party, the CCP.
No, we are not paid by the CCP to make specific positive content about China.
What is clear, however, is that Beijing approves of these messages. Why else would these commentators be getting airtime on state-owned TV channels?
Daniel, very much welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me. I have been approached recently by quite a few media outlets, and this is the only one I chose to go on because...
We messaged Daniel Dumbrill, requested an interview, and didn't get a response. CGTN appears to be his favored broadcaster. He's also been endorsed by China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. At the end of March, an online discussion he hosted about accusations of genocide in Xinjiang was played at one of the ministry's press briefings.
We have a precedent for fake propaganda created to serve America's geopolitical interests.
That video was then tweeted by spokesperson Hua Chunying, one of the most prominent faces of the Chinese government.
I think there are a couple of different reasons why the Chinese government is pushing back so hard in recent months on what's happening in Xinjiang. First and foremost, we're starting to see some more serious steps in the pursuit of investigations into what's happening in Xinjiang through a body like the UN Human Rights Council. And I think the Chinese government feels an overwhelming urge to push back against that.
There's been more of a coordinated Western effort. The US, EU, UK, Canada, they've issued sanctions against Chinese officials. Several Western countries have openly called what's happening to the Uyghurs a genocide. So as we see a level of coordination rise among Western allies, China is amping up their propaganda.
So the idea that the Chinese government has to have certain points conveyed by foreigners rather than by saying it themselves is actually a pretty old one. You have directives from the 60s by Mao Zedong himself to say, you know, we all know China is the center of the world revolution, but we have to have foreigners say it for us because that way it's going to be more credible. And this basic logic still holds.
That doesn't mean Chinese officials have retreated from the media. On the contrary, as pressure about the situation in Xinjiang has intensified in recent months, Beijing's counterattack has become more forceful.
So the primary thing that the Chinese Communist Party wants dissidents or, you know, human rights activists, journalists to do is to just shut up. So any kind of leverage they can use on people, they will. There was the case recently where two Uyghur women were interviewed on BBC and they talked about, you know, the rape that happens in these camps. And the Chinese state-run media went and found the family of one of these women and they made her family essentially denounce her on camera.
The Chinese government and its allies push back against organizations like Human Rights Watch or researchers like Adrian Zenz or Vicky Xu. But I have to say that I think that for Human Rights Watch, the single biggest frustration is that, you know, nobody from the Chinese government has the guts to sit down and talk with us on the facts.
Instead, President Xi Jinping's government plays the whataboutism card on human rights abuses and legal double standards in the Western world. It's a tactic that evades rather than informs. But Western state-sanctioned crimes, wars, coups, illegal imprisonments give Beijing and its influencers of choice a lot to work with.
This is a very weird point that I hear a lot of anti-Chinese people pushing. Oh, China's very aggressive. And this is very bizarre to hear coming from Americans because while the United States is in multiple wars simultaneously, today, China is in zero wars.
They're taking legitimate criticisms of the US government and trying to say just because the US government has these issues, nothing that has been so far reported about the Uyghurs can possibly be true.
It's fairly ironic because you can be angry at what the US does and you can also be angry at what China does. These don't have to be mutually exclusive. But there, of course, the party state has now discovered these groups and is trying to integrate them into their messaging because they're bringing across this key message, don't look at us, look at America.
And for those who insist on looking at China, there are videos out there. Just don't mistake what you're watching for journalism.
In Xinjiang, I thought the best way is to go and live like a cotton farmer. And actually, I think I'll fit in quite well because a lot of people tell me I look like I'm from Xinjiang.
If it was real journalism, Beijing would be looking to control it, not promote it.
And finally, last week we ran that video, the one that went viral, of an Israeli man telling a Palestinian family to leave their home in East Jerusalem, telling them that if he didn't steal it, some other Israeli would. Given everything that's happened since, it is worth remembering. That's where this current story, the bombing of Gaza, the communal fighting, got its start. On the notion of home, Palestinian filmmaker Omar Ramel has produced a simple, powerful video on dispossession and what it means, depending on which community you call home in the Holy Land. 6 million views and counting. We'll see you next time here at The Listening Post.
مطبخي. مش لأنه طبخي ذاتي، لا، بس لأنه هون بنجمع أكثر إشي. نطبخ، ناكل، بنحكي، يعني المطبخ عنا زي ما تقولوا بحر بالحب.
أكثر إشي بربطني بالدار هي غرفة القعدة. أمي بتضلها تبهدلني أنا وأصحابي، بتفتح الشبابيك من كتر ريحة الدخان.
أكثر مكان نقعد فيه وقت بالبيت غرفتي، لأن ماما وبابا عملوا لي بيت للألعاب فيه. أنا كمان بس أكبر بدي أكون زي ماما وأعمل بيت زي الأولادي.
أكثر إشي بحبه بهالدار هاي الشجرة. هاي الشجرة زرعها سيدي الله يرحمه أول ما عمر الدار، وكان يحبها ويدير باله عليها كأنها حدا من أولاده. وهلأ زي ما أنتم شايفين قاعدين تحتها إحنا والعيلة. إيش